couple of songs there from Grammy-winning singer-songwriter Melissa Manchester. We heard Rainbird, and then also, or we started with Looking Through the Eyes of Love, and now we will be listening to the voice of love and music. God, that's a terrible segue, but we're very, very happy to have with us in the neighborhood the winner of a special award for outstanding contribution to American popular music. That'll be given at the 27th Annual Bistro Awards, being held this Monday night at the Gotham Comedy Club. And actually, you can be there if you want to be there. Tickets are available. I think they're $60 plus a two-drink minimum. For more information, go to bistroawards.com. But if you want to see even more of Melissa Manchester, go to Long Island in May, because she's doing a gig at the Patchogue Theater. Then she'll be in New York at the Blue Note Theater on May 14th. But we have her with us right now on the phone. Melissa, can you hear me?
I sure can. Good morning, or good afternoon to you, huh?
Good morning here, and good afternoon to you there. You're calling from New York. And first of all, congratulations on the Bistro Award. Yay for you.
Thanks very much.
When did they tell you? When do you find out about these sorts of things?
I was approached with this lovely news about a month or so ago. And any chance I can get back into New York, I jump at, and it was very lovely to be acknowledged, and so I said yes.
Well, I mean, in announcing the Bistro Awards, my close friend, I should say, Sherry Eaker, who has been producing the awards since 1990, said, the people who have won, and by the way, she's joining a company of people like Kay Ballard and Dee Dee Bridgewater.
Yes.
Sherry Eaker says, quote, "These artists have influenced popular culture through their songs and performances, each in their own distinctive ways." And Melissa Manchester has been doing this since the 1970s. And I didn't even realize you had gone to the Fame High School, the High School of the Performing Arts.
I did. In its original location on 46th Street, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So are your memories of that like the movie, like the TV show, or is that sort of glamorized and glorified in some weird ways?
Oh, no, the school was they really captured the spirit of the school and the actual funk of the building in the movie. It was wild to be going to this wonderful high school in the middle of the theater district. It was wonderful to have half the day spent on the disciplines of the creative arts and then the other half on academics. And I was, you know, I was starting to work while I was in school. I was starting to sing at jingle sessions and have all kinds of fantastic adventures that could only happen in New York.
Wow. And at what point then, even younger, did you realize or did people tell you, hey, you know, you can't, it's not that you can just carry a tune, but you can really sing. How old were you? And you know, when did you get that moment of like, oh, I should really be doing this a lot?
Well, it came at an unusually early age. When I was 5 years old, I heard Ella Fitzgerald sing Gershwin, and that was it for me. I just knew what I was doing. I didn't understand it on the how to get there level, but I just knew that that was the soul shift for me.
And were you taking music lessons before high school?
Oh, yeah. My parents insisted that my sister and I take piano lessons, and we did. But I was not a very good student in most things. And so instead of actually learning what was on the page, I started to improvise. And then I started to write my own songs, and that's how that all evolved.
Do you remember the very, very first song you ever wrote?
I do indeed. It was called Single Heart, and the second one I wrote was called Skip a Beat, and I sold them for $50.
Nice. I mean, was it Brill Building stuff, or how did you go about selling those?
You know what? I showed up sort of 15 minutes after the Brill Building scene was kind of over.
Right.
I was writing with Carol Sager, she had really been at the tail end of the Brill Building, so she really had that experience. But what had happened was that when I was in NYU, School of the Arts, for 1 year, and I met two lovely young songwriters, Jeffrey Sweet, who's become quite a prominent playwright,
of course,
and Chris
yeah.
Mitchell, and they knew that I was a singer. And so they asked me to sing their songs up at different publishing companies so that maybe they could land a publishing gig. And I would watch them write. and to that I've been a poet, I've been a published poet. And I went back into my mother's living room where the grand was, and I sat down and started writing, and it was like a second voice showed up. Suddenly I was writing a lot, and that's how it started.
My gosh, and I was going to hold this till later, but since you mentioned him, and it's not like I'm name-dropping or anything, but also Jeff Sweet is a close friend, and...
Oh, how lovely.
Yeah, oh yeah, well, because we're both theater critics together for many years, and he's also a playwright, of course, and so, you know, I knew him from all these different theater organizations, as
right.
well as he came and talked to my playwriting class a couple of years ago, well, by telephone, but... Because I was out in Colorado by then. So how is it working on... Because you actually wrote an off-Broadway musical called I Sent a Letter to My Love. That was quite nice. I remember seeing that years ago. And how was that experience for you?
Well, it was... I didn't really know what I was getting into. I know that I loved theater, and Jeff had great faith in me that I had a certain magical voice in my music. And the story was so compelling... And even though it took us for frickin' ever to finish it, you know, we did lots of workshops, and then, of course, I'd be on the road or somewhere. But it took a very long time to finish it. But the experience was fantastic because I really understood that in theater, your songs serve such a specific purpose, very different from writing a pop song. And the idea of having a song as the instrument by which you move a story forward was just very powerful and compelling to me. So I'm working on a new musical now, with Rupert Holmes, and Sharon Vaughan, and we had our first table reading, and we'll see.
Well, can you tell us a little more what it's about? What's the show?
No. But I will soon enough, hopefully.
Okay, I'll get involved. Yeah, certainly. And it's going to be a big year for Rupert Holmes because they're bringing Edmund Drood back to Broadway.
Yes, they are indeed.
So,
yeah.
Cool. Let's also roll it back. So you've gotten out of the high school for the performing arts. You're bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, full of talent.
Yeah.
What next?
Well, because I was in Manhattan, I kept stumbling on these incredible adventures. I was a jingle singer, and so I met other incredible jingle singers like Barry Manilow and Nick Ashford and Valerie Simpson and Patty Austin. And at the time, Barry was musical director for Bette Midler, who was just playing at the Continental Baths, and I sort of played on occasion diagonally across the street from that place in a club called The Focus. You know, she came in off with Barry, and they caught my set, and she had just been on the Carson show, and I got to meet her and ask her what she was up to, and she said she was getting ready for her first Carnegie Hall concert, and I asked her if she was going to have any background singers, and she said, I don't know. And I said, well, actually, I'd like to sing instead of you, but I'd be happy to sing in back of you for a while. And so Barry and I organized what became the Harlettes. And I was with her as a background singer for about 6 months, and then off I went. But in the meantime, I had these, in addition to that adventure, I was an usher at the Vivian Beaumont Theater. I parked cars for a little theater company on the East Side. I was an intern at the Children's Television Workshop during the first season of Sesame Street.
Whoa, all right. Hold on. Stop. I let you roll past all the stuff about organizing the Harlettes with Barry Manilow. I should have stopped you there just to go more in detail about it. So that's what I'm going to do, and then we'll get back to CTW. All right. So what was it like being a Harlette and a Harlette organizer in back of Bette Midler for half a year with Barry Manilow?
It was wild. I mean, because, you know, all of us were sort of traveling in a pack, and we just sort of kept an eye on each other to see who was making the next step up the ladder.
Hmm.
And, you know, as I said, Barry and I were jingle singers, and so we knew Merle Miller and Gail Kantor and brought them in to be the Harlettes, and I was the Toots in the middle. And it was fantastic to watch Bette cast her spell on the audience because it was a new kind of performing in an age of American popular culture going through some kind of a shift. As a songwriter, what constituted lyrics was change. There was much more poetry and metaphor and psychology involved in songwriting. And in terms of entertainment, I mean, Bette was, Bette, though she was adorable and naughty and all of that, she was so brilliant. And to see her brilliance, you know, be taken as face value entertainment and fantastic, but to see how brilliant she was and that underneath all of that sparkle was just a fantastically brilliant woman.
Can I ask, how different was she, like, as soon as the lights went down and the curtain closed? Was she, I assume, of course, she worked extremely hard, but how would you say she was a different person, like, in the rehearsal room or on the street or in the diner after the show than she was, you know, in the baths and in the concerts?
Well, you know, Bette always described herself as having the soul of a librarian. She's kind of a reserved, serious, and thoughtful woman, even though she has this madcap streak, which she attributes to her late mother. But because she has such an appreciation of show business history and glamour and the hard work that it went, she always appreciated the hard work that went into stuff as opposed to just getting the surface of it. I mean, she really was a student of whatever was interesting to her. And that's why her shows are so unbelievable. You know, she really knows how to bring in people extremely unique in their thinking. So it was great. We speak on rare occasions, but I think of her fondly. Barry and I are still sweet friends.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
So I now as him, as, I assume, as, sorry?
As a matter of fact, in my show, we do, he and I do a virtual duet, which is really lovely.
Well, that's good. And, but see, with Barry Manilow, I kind of assume he's the same on stage and off. Is that, you know, just the charming,
yeah,
sweet, nebbishy New York, Brooklyn-y kind of a guy. Am I right?
Yeah, because he's basically a musician. And, you know, those of us who are musicians are basically the same. We just dress better on stage.
Well, that is so cool. By the way, we're talking, of course, with Melissa Manchester, who was telling us about, well, singing backup for Bette Midler, arranging the Harlettes, parking cars, being involved in theater companies, and spending the first year working at Children's Television Workshop on a little show called Sesame Street. What have your What are your memories of that?
Well, I'm telling you, my teenage years were wild, because I just kept stumbling, literally stumbling onto places. I lived on 88th Street. My parents' apartment was on 88th Street in Broadway. And I walked down because I saw this place. There was a big sign on the second floor that said CGW. And I had the chutzpah to walk down there and knock on the door at the ripe old age of 17. The guy opened the door and I said, "Can I do something?" And he said, "Sure, come on in." You know, this was before security checks, whatever,
yeah, yeah.
And I was ushered into the editing room, and I became an intern. And what was fabulous was that the discussion in the editing room at that moment was what would happen to the integrity of the show Sesame Street if they came out with a line of toys.
Wow.
And I just love that memory. Yeah, yeah. And so I saw the beginning of it, and I just was there for a while. I mean, that's what these memories were. They were just lovely adventures along the way.
Well, sure. I mean, people don't seem to remember, especially because I had a black and white TV for many years, but Oscar was orange that first year.
Yep.
People don't recall that because he's been green for so long.
Yeah.
And then, and one of the cool things is a few years back I had folk singer Oscar Brand on the program, and he, you know, very opinionated fellow, and he remembers being one of the people helping to set up, like, this committee that was putting Sesame Street together. And he was saying that there was all these arguments of trying to make it more New York, urban, gritty, almost ghetto kind of show. And then, you know, public television got involved, and he said, no, let's sweeten it a little bit, and it's not going to be, there's not going to be, you know, hypodermic needles along the street. It's not going to be like that.
Right. the basic premise was that if kids could learn how to repeat commercials and sing commercials, then they could learn how to repeat and sing the alphabet, and then everything else just followed. So they used the mindset of kids listening to commercials, and of course there were all sorts of discussions, but that was a central point.
So when
they used what's in the ear.
What was the highest level you were, in other words, by the time you left CTW, what were you still in the editing room, or how were you involved in the process?
Oh, I was really just a gopher. I went to some of the sessions that Joe Raposo had composed for, and that was wonderful, and we had stayed in touch a little bit for several years and before he passed away too early. And so, I was just there for a little bit of time, and then I went on to the next one.
Amazing. So, okay, you're out of CTW, you're away from Parking Cars, you're starting to work with Bette Midler and the Harlettes, and then your career, how did that take off?
Well, around that time, when I was about 18, I started to perform in the coffee shops of Greenwich Village, and then I started to perform in the New York State University coffee shop circuit, and so I was pretty busy, my bass player and myself, and we did that for years, and in the meantime, I would make demos for my singing monies,
right,
and
well, yeah.
Send in the demos to different record companies and be rejected and rejected and rejected and rejected and rejected, and it took 7 years until I got a reel.
Now, how did that happen? What song was it? What was that little moment that clicked? That, you know, whoever it was, it Arista or?
No, that was before Arista. It was for, I did an audition for the late great Larry Utah, who was the president of Bell Records, and his guys, and I performed my songs, and he turned to me, and you know, by this time I had 7 years of rejection under my belt, and he said, I like what you do. How important is this to you? I said, look, I'm going to do this with you or without you. And he looked at his guys, and his guys looked at him, and I said, thank you very much, and I left, and the next thing I knew, I had a record deal.
Amazing, amazing. And was there a point also when you knew that you had leapt to a next level? So, okay, you got the recording deal, and then, okay, you get to make an album, but when was that moment when you realized, oh, I'm having a career now?
Yeah, it's funny. I think there were two things that happened. You know, the first two albums were pretty well received on the college circuit, and that's lovely. But when Bell Records was absorbed into Arista and Midnight Blue first came out, and it finally got up the charts, and we worked like dogs to push it up the charts and, pardon me, supported on different tours. At one point, I was somewhere, and I played the introduction to Midnight Blue, and the place erupted into cheers, and I went, oops, something's changed. Yeah.
Oh, wait, I think we lost your cell phone there for a minute. Are you still there? Melissa, we got you?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Your cell phone cut out for a moment, but...
Well,
no, we're back. Happily, you are back. So now, okay, it's the 1970s. You're having pop chart career, and were you? Actually, I forgot to ask this. Since let's go back one little bit, going back to your NYU days, and you talked about Jeff Sweet, but Wiki says that you had a class taught by Paul Simon.
I did.
Any memories of anything he taught you? And what was that like? You okay?
Well, yeah. I went to NYU for 1 year.
Uh-huh.
And the year after I left, Jeff and his friend Brett noticed on the billboard that Paul Simon was going to be teaching a class in songwriting. And they called me and they said, would you like us to sign you up? And they did. And Paul auditioned everybody that had put their name on the list. And I got into the class, as did Jeff. And I thought it was fascinating. I mean, he was coming from being in the trenches. He wasn't just talking about the theory of the music industry. He was really living it, including all the nonsense and wishing catastrophes like that. And the class was run very simply. Everybody had to come in with one song a week, and somebody would be chosen to perform the song, and we'd analyze it, including him.
And he would bring in these these guest artists every once in a while. And I remember being on the, you know, in Greenwich Village, and suddenly Isaac Stern shows up in his tuxedo after a performance. And I thought, wow.
Whoa.
Yeah, and he had he did not try to hide his disdain for American popular music at the time, but he showed up and it was kind of fun. But the thing about Paul that was so memorable is that he synthesized the challenge of writing a pop song. He simply said, you know, all of the stories have been told. It's the way you tell your story that becomes your uniqueness. And at the time, young writers were really challenging language. The Beatles had written Obladi Oblada, and Laura Nero had written Stone Soul Picnic. And so kind of all bets were off on how to use language. So it was a really interesting moment to be in that class, and it was fantastic.
Do you know if, or do you recall if, you said Paul Simon was actually auditioning some of his own songs? Were there any songs in there that he wrote that ended up becoming, you know, fairly well known? That he auditioned in front of you guys?
Not that I recall, but I do remember him discussing Bridge Over Troubled Waters, which was sort of number one all over the world at the moment.
Wow.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's crazy that he was teaching while he was having this larger life. But he talked about Bridge Over Troubled Waters, and he talked about the bridge, you know, Sail on Silver Girl. The truth is, this Sail on Silver Girl has nothing to do with the song. He wrote it about an old girlfriend who became prematurely gray.
Oh.
And it just seemed to find its way into the song. And I'm thinking, okay, all right, I'll follow you anywhere. He thought so interestingly. He had immense intellectual curiosity, besides being a magnificent creator, and so it was unbelievable.
Wow! Well, I'm so glad I asked about that. You know, because I was moving backwards in time, and we were moving forward. But I'm very glad I asked Melissa Manchester about taking a class with Paul Simon. So, okay, Now we're back in the 1970s, and it's that era of glitz and New York glamour and Truman Capote and the disco. How far did you dip into that New York wild SNL culture of the time?
Well, I was pretty much traveling my own path, I guess. I was a singer-songwriter who was playing lots of clubs. I remember hanging out in clubs. I was never part of the Andy Warhol scene. And I was on the road a lot. But the thing I remember was that there seemed to have been an ease to bohemian life. Rent, you know, you could still live in New York really cheaply if you knew the neighborhood.
Wow.
You could find ways to earn a living. There were just adventures that you could find you. I think it had to do with being so young and traveling in an interesting crowd. You know, I think that sort of attracts energy. But I simply don't know if that New York exists anymore.
Well, financially, it certainly doesn't. I got the hell out of New York when I couldn't afford it, that's for sure. You know.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, you okay? You there? Oh.
I'm here.
Oh, cool. Well, we are talking with Melissa Manchester. I want to ask, now having had a long and continuing life in the music business, how has the sea change, and I ask this of all the musical performers who are on here, of the way music is produced, recorded, and certainly promoted and distributed, and the sea change that's happened in the last 10, 15 years. What are your thoughts on that? Has it been great? Has it been up and down? And how has it specifically affected the way you do what you do?
Well, that is awesome. Because I've been doing this so long, I mean, this is a year career now, I saw the first sea change in the early 80s when electronics insinuated itself into the studios. And so suddenly recording became a producer's milieu as opposed to an artist, really, in my opinion. And so suddenly the concoctions of the songs were much more about the atmosphere of the song as opposed to the song itself. And that's where I started to consider bailing for a while. And I did. I left the industry for a while, for several years. I had kids to raise. And I had, so I wrote projects for Disney. I wrote the score for Lady and the Tramp 2 with Norman Gimbel. And that kept me home and, you know, able to deal with my kids and be there for them. And when I, and I just, you know, I couldn't fathom how the industry was changing, you know, because I'm a balladeer at heart.
Right.
And melody driven. And it's funny because Paul Simon had written about the fact that American popular music will be changing from melody driven to rhythm driven. And when it, once it does that, then it changes the actual shape of a song, and it's true. And when I came back, and realized that the landscape had become unrecognizable, that the whole indie rock scene showed up, that social networking had allowed people to get their music out, not effortlessly, but without the need of a big engine behind it. It was interesting to watch, and but what I know is to be true is that independent recording is really code word for you have to do four times as much work yourself.
Okay.
And you know, and I get that. And if you don't know any different, then that's your normal. So yes, you do get artistic freedom, and that's a very good thing. And yes, there are unbelievably new ways where you don't even have to make a record, and you can have a career. So it's fascinating. I mean, the wheel has effectively been reinvented, and I'm not exactly sure if it's round anymore.
Wow. Nicely, or as Dylan used to say, the wheel's still in spin. You know, it really is.
Yeah.
So, what are you working on these days? What are your current projects besides obviously touring and doing concerts?
Yeah. Well, we had our first reading of the musical,
right.
And so that goes on. And I'm writing a lot. And in the last year, I've had remarkable adventures in film. You played the song Rainbird. That was from a film called Dirty Girl, which is on DVD, and it's a beautiful and funny and witty movie that takes place in Norman, Oklahoma in 1987. And there's a major soundtrack, and it's, I was told by the director, Abe Sylvia, that it's sort of an homage to me because The story's about a young gay boy who has nobody to talk to about his life and this teenage girl, and they meet in a detention class and become fast friends in a weird way. And because his life is so small, the only way he connects to the larger world is through my music. And so I have 9 songs in there.
Wow.
And the cast was includes William Macy and Mary Steenburgen and Mila Jovovich and Tim McGraw and Dwight Yoakam, and it's a wonderful movie. And but in the middle of the film, they needed an original song, and Mary Steenburgen is also a great lyricist, so we wrote Rainbird for the film, and it made the first list of Academy Awards nominations, and you know, then the Academy Award, I guess, lost its head and only nominated 2 officially. But anyway, so I did that. And the other thing, the other song that's on playlist, which is a live recording, is called I Know Who I Am. And that was recorded by Leona Lewis and was in Tyler Perry's For Colored Girls.
Oh, man. Huh.
So, yeah, so you just never know what a song will do or where it will be. I have a song that is in a one-man show starring, are you ready?
Yeah.
Mike Tyson. So you just never know where your songs will show up and how they can be of service to a larger project.
So when you say it was he used it as background, or when he was coming, how did that connect to the Mike Tyson show? What do you mean?
Well, it's, yeah, the show is called The Undisputed Truth, and it played for a week in Las Vegas, and I think it's going to have a much larger tour.
Right,
I just
but,
wanted to look at it.
And, but how
and
is your
the way
song?
They use,
yeah,
right. The way they use my song, "A Mother's Prayer," is that at the, toward the end of the evening, where he talks about his path of redemption and why he's actually doing this show, he talks about his family and his kids and how that has sort of impacted his life, and how at a certain point you just slow down and you look at the crazy choices or the uninformed choices, so they use my song. A blues singer sings my song, and you see pictures of his children, and it's very touching.
Cool. Well, congratulations on that and all the things that you are working on and have worked on for all these years. We have just a couple of minutes left with Melissa Manchester here in the Daybrook. I want to ask you another question that I tend to ask everybody who's in music and making music, and that is, what do you listen to these days? Do you have an iPod? And if you do, what's on it? Or if you don't, what's on your CD player?
I don't have an iPod. I listen to a lot of artists on NPR, and I don't know their names. My kids listen to a lot of really interesting music. I like Bon Iver. I think he's really interesting. I like Florence and the Machine. I love Adele. I think she's the real deal, and she is attracting the attention of those that came before her, you know, Judy and Ella and Edith and Rosie and Billy and all of those. She's in that tradition. And for me, she's the heir apparent to Dusty Springfield. So the fact that she writes these extremely soulful pop songs, it's unbelievable.
Cool. Yeah, I've heard Adele almost every time I've asked this in the past year. Adele always comes up from everybody I talk to. There's just something about whatever her quality is. And I also want to ask, I mean, you've done not just behind the scenes, but you have done theater. I had no idea about this, unless Wiki is wrong. But at one point, you were in Sweeney Todd with Kelsey Grammer?
Yeah.
When was...
I played Beggar Woman. It was for the 25th anniversary of Sweeney Todd.
Uh-huh.
And it was here at the Amundsen Theater, and Christine Baranski played Mrs. Lovett.
Oh.
And what was so lovely about Beggar Woman is that they allowed me to sing a song that had been cut from the original version. And so that was great, and Mr. Sondheim was there, and it was unbelievable.
Did you get to meet Stephen Sondheim after the show? Did you shake a hand?
I did indeed. Yeah, I did indeed. And it was amazing. But yes, I did Sweeney Todd. I took over for Bernadette Peters in the National Tour of Song and Dance by Andrew Lloyd Webber. I starred in a show called Hats a couple of years ago at the Royal George Theater in Chicago. It was an interesting concoction. The score was written by a whole bunch of different writers, and it was about the Red Hat Society ladies. It was fun.
Are you going to do more theater, you hope, or you know?
I do hope so. Yes, I do hope so. I understand the rigors of performing live. I just do. And so we'll see.
So I guess the last question for the wonderful Melissa Manchester, who, by the way, once again, letting you know, will be receiving a special award for her outstanding contribution to American popular music this Monday at the Gotham Comedy Club for the Bistro Awards. That's on West 23rd Street. Folks who are interested in attending can go to bistroawards.com. Also, for my Long Island listeners, she'll be at the Patchogue Theater on Long Island on May 12th. Go to patchogtheater.com for more information on that. And on May 14th, she's at the legendary Blue Note Jazz Club in New York. Go to bluenote.net for that. But let me just finally ask Melissa Manchester, besides, you know, we've talked for 40 minutes about music and recording and acting and, you know, backup singing and all of that, what are you doing when you're not doing all of that? What's your basic daily life like?
Every day is different. You know, I love to cook. I write. I spend time with my daughter or my son or friends. You know, I don't see my friends enough. I don't see my kids enough. So I just, because to me to work, I have to get on the plane and go someplace. But sometimes my daughter sings with me on the road, and that's great. And it's an interesting life. You just never know what's going to show up when the phone rings.
It's funny. I was going to ask you if the kids went into the showbiz. So I guess your daughter, is she a full-time singer as well?
She is. Her name is Hannah Manchester, and we sing together on occasion.
Oh, and is her son out of the business or in the business, or what does he do?
My son does. He's wonderful. He's a nerd, and he works at a temple.
Thank you, Mom.
Yeah, I know he's going to kill me for that. But he's a fantastic guy. He just is not interested in the artistic life. He wants another path.
He wants another. Oh, how old is he? On the path already, or is he still rather young?
Well, my kids are young adults. My son is 25, my daughter's 23.
Oh, yeah, so they're grown-ups. So, yeah, in other words, is he in... Yeah. Oh, God help us, is he in computers, or is he a lawyer or something like that?
He's a computer guy. He's a computer genius. And, you can find my daughter's videos of her performances on YouTube.
Cool. And, again, it's Hannah Manchester is the daughter. And, of course, you have a website, which I should have noted down. I assume it's... Oh, yes, I do. It's melissamanchester.com. And there's a little hyphen in there, but I don't think you have to put the hyphen in. Sorry?
Not necessarily. You can get on the website without the hyphen.
And also, just wondering, I mean, I'm hinting, and I don't know the whole biographical, I assume you've been divorced for a while, because you're not talking about a husband when you talk about family. What's happening with you socially? Are you dating? Are you seeing somebody? Blah, blah, blah.
No, I've been married a very long time. We're about to have our 30th anniversary.
Funny how you kept leaving him out. Is he in the business?
No, I've been married a very long time.
Mazel tov.
Thank you very much.
And what does your husband do?
He's a building manager, and he's a production guy, and, he's a jack-of-all-trades kind of guy.
Well, Mick Mazel. I didn't know, because she's mentioning the kids, she's talking about, she sees the kids now, and it's like, funny how you left the fella out. Shame on you, Melissa. But congratulations on the award, on your touring, on your music, on all the projects, and good luck. Certainly, hope to hear more about the musical that you've been writing. You can't say more about it, but we'll keep our ears and eyes open. And
thank you. And I would like to just mention one more thing for the Patchogue fans. After I do my show, which I do in two acts, I do come out to the lobby and sign things and give hugs and get to say hello to people. So. I do announce that from the stage, but it's nice for people to know that.
Oh, well, yeah, moral of the story is don't just throw your coat on and leave, because Melissa will be back there signing CDs and talking to you and shaking hands, which is, again, that is the new way that music is done these days. It is the personal touch that makes all the difference. And your music really has made a difference in lots and lots of people's lives. So everybody...
Thanks.
Go to Melissa Manchester's website, go to her concerts on Long Island and New York, and hopefully you'll come out to Colorado at some point soon, too. And wishing you the very, very best in the rest of your life and career. Thank you, Melissa Manchester, for being in the neighborhood.
Thanks for inviting me. Bye.
Bye-bye.